Welcome all. Today we are very happy to have Mark van Ramstong from UBC, and he will talk about cosmology from the vacuum. Please keep your microphones muted and only unmute if you want to ask questions. Mark, the stage is yours.
Okay, so thanks a lot for the invitation. I'm going to talk about some recent work that kind of goes back to a paper from, a few years ago now with Moshe Rosali, Brian Swingle, Chris Waddell, and David Wakeham, and Sean Cooper that we had. And I've talked about this before at PI, but what I'll focus on today is more recent work, and specifically, sorry, I didn't even update the bottom slide. So this is now a paper with the title that's the same as the title of the seminar. And so the recent paper is with Brian Swingle and my student Peter Samidja and Stefano Antonini. Okay, so the subject is basically trying to understand if we can use ADS-CFT somehow to come up with actual models of cosmology, so some microscopic models of cosmology. So, you know, string theory and ADS-CFT were they seem to give us nice examples of fully non-perturbative models of quantum gravity, and we've been able to address, at least try to address, a bunch of interesting questions that we would want a theory of quantum gravity for. So understanding the physics of black holes, understanding like really high energy scattering processes where gravitational effects could be important. And then even understanding some things that we didn't maybe think we needed to understand like going into trying to find a theory of quantum gravity. So we've understood things like the emergence of space-time through holography and connections with quantum information theory. So there's a lot of progress, but I think relatively little understanding of this other direction that would be one of the core reasons for wanting to understand a quantum theory of gravity. I say understanding the physics of the Big Bang and the physics of cosmology out of a microscopic theory. Okay, and so I want to talk about some approach to that today, but I want to start, with a little bit of a general discussion about like trying to describe cosmology with holography or string theory. And I think it's kind of possibly a misconception in the community that, the main obstacle to describing cosmology using string theory or holography is this kind of apparent observation that our universe has a positive cosmological constant. And you know, that's different than what we seem to be able to describe easily using ADS-CFT, which is quantum gravity theories with a negative cosmological constant. Okay, so I want to emphasize that, you know, the observations are really not that we have a positive cosmological constant in our universe. Rather, the observations are that we are currently in a phase of acceleration of the scale factor. And so, you know, we could draw the history of the scale factor schematically like that. So it's accelerating a little bit presently. We can ask, what does that imply about the energy in the universe? And so we could take this kind of a scale factor, plug it into Einstein's equations, and the acceleration tells us this particular result, that if we take the stress energy tensor to have a perfect fluid form, then 3p plus 3 pressure times the energy density plus the energy density is less than zero. Okay, so that's what it tells us. And maybe the simplest thing we could do to get something that satisfies this equation or this inequality is to just take a positive cosmological constant. But it's not really the only thing that we could do in the context of like effective descriptions of cosmology. Another very simple thing we could imagine is that instead of the ring, a cosmological constant, which is positive, there's rather some scalar fields, and the scalar fields have a potential energy, which is currently positive. But in that case, we could have this energy changing with time if the scalars were actually rolling or changing with time, then the potential could also be changing with time. So it could be currently positive, but then, you know, later on it could change. And so in a sense, this positive lambda is just a special case of this where all of the scalars are not changing with time, and we're at some minimum of a potential where the potential happens to be positive. But let's consider the more general possibility. And so I think it's quite natural actually to consider this more general possibility, just given our observations. If we wanted to write down the most general background consistent with the symmetries of cosmology that we observe, then you would naturally allow time dependence for any scalar fields in the theory. So that sort of preserves the same symmetries as the time dependent scale factor. Okay. And so, as I said, if it happens that the acceleration currently is because of a positive potential, and the scalars are not currently at a minimum of their potential, then it's typical that they're going to be time dependent. If you look at the equations for the evolution of that scalar, they correspond to, it's the same equations as a particle in the potential with some damping given by 3 times the Hubble. So the natural thing for those scalars to do is just roll down. And so you would generically expect that at later times in the universe, the potential from the scalar fields will be less. And since the current value is this tiny positive value of this potential energy, it's pretty natural that sometime later you would actually roll down to negative values. Okay, so it may well be that if we wanted to say, if we had this this situation with the scalars, which are not at a minimum currently, then it's pretty plausible that maybe the nearest minimum that we would be rolling towards is actually at a negative value. Okay, so just to sort of summarize, in terms of explaining our observations, we could explain acceleration by having a positive cosmological constant, but we could also have potential for scalars that are changing with time. And then in that case, the actual cosmological constant, which we might define as some nearby extremum of the potential that we're going towards, well, that could be positive, but perhaps there's a lot more space available for that minimum to be some negative value. Okay. I should just mention at this point that there are constraints on these sort of scenarios with the rolling scalars. They can't be changing too quickly. This probably translates into a potential that is relatively flat. But as I'll say later in the talk, we can understand some natural ways for that to come about. Okay, so given these possibilities for explaining our observations, now we could ask, well, if we want to try to come up with some string theory models for cosmology, what should we focus on? And I think a lot of the focus has been on this first possibility, trying to think about how do we construct vacua with positive lambda, and is there some holographic version of de Sitter space? But I think, in a sense, given the current state of string theory, it seems actually perhaps quite a bit more natural to focus on another possibility, which is lambda less than zero. And so if we think about, there's a couple of reasons for that. I mean, if we think about string theory, there are typically a lot of scalar fields in the effective theories that you get from string compactifications. And so it would be perhaps natural for some of those to have a time dependence. And then we have, this beautiful microscopic understanding of at least many examples of quantum gravity theories with lambda less than zero through holography. Whereas with lambda greater than zero, it still seems to be even controversial whether any vacua of string theory exists. So I think that given the present state of string theory, in a sense, it seems like our efforts might be better focused on just, trying to construct models using string theory for lambda less than zero cosmology and try to explain the acceleration of the universe by a positive potential currently And so that's kind of the direction that I want to take in this talk. Okay. So we want to kind of focus on this possibility that lambda is less than zero, and then maybe we have some time-dependent scalars. We'll come back to the scalars later, but now let's just sort of ask, can we come up with models of cosmology using string theory or holography with, you know, that have lambda less than zero? And so, as I said, ADS-CFT gives us a way to microscopically describe many theories of quantum gravity with lambda less than zero. But it's actually still not trivial if we want to actually describe cosmology with lambda less than zero. There's a little bit more work that we have to do, or it's not really obvious how to do that. And the reason is that when we're using ADS-CFT, so we're describing quantum gravity using some dual field theory, but then in the examples that we understand, the quantum gravity theories that we're describing in that way, they describe spacetimes that are kind of boring asymptotically. So you could have lots of interesting matter, black holes, gravitational waves, whatever, but that tends to be localized in some region of spacetime or of space. And asymptotically, these geometries that we can describe holographically are empty. So they're empty and they're negatively curved. And that's sort of that's not the same thing that we want to do when we're describing cosmology. With cosmology, the basic assumption is that we have a universe filled with matter that's homogeneous and isotropic. Okay. So it's not really clear what exactly we should do. Just another perspective on that, you know, if we look at these lambda less than zero cosmologies, so we could take a really simple example where you just have the negative cosmological constant, and then you add some radiation. So it's probably the simplest lambda less than zero cosmology. Okay, so let's understand what do these cosmologies look like. And so typically, the negative lambda causes the universe to collapse eventually. So if you start out expanding, the cosmological constant becomes more and more important as the radiation dilutes. And then eventually that leads to a turnaround and a crunch. And so the structure of these things is typically a big bang, big crunch cosmology. The space-time diagram looks like this here on the right, and you have a big bang, big crunch. And importantly, there's no asymptotically ADS region. So lambda less than zero is not really implying asymptotically ADS in the context of cosmology when you have homogeneous and isotropic matter or radiation. So what do we do? So this is kind of a point where we need some further insight. And so for us, the insight is going to be a particular mathematical observation. Okay, so the observation is that even though this cosmology, it doesn't have any asymptotically ADS regions in the normal geometry, there's sort of a mathematical trick, I guess, that we could do to find ADS. And so the observation is that if you take this spacetime, and actually many other spacetimes with lambda less than zero as well. This is just a particular example. If you imagine analytically continuing the geometry, so just considering imaginary values of the time coordinate. Okay. So then taking that geometry, going to the imaginary time slice in the complexified geometry, you actually find a geometry which has a pair of asymptotically ADS regions. Okay, so even though the cosmological spacetime doesn't have these boundaries, the analytic continuation does. So that's, I guess, interesting from the point of view of holography. But then the question is, well, what are we supposed to do with that information? Okay, and so at this point, I want to remind you that Euclidean versions of quantum field theories or quantum gravity theories are actually also often utilized and are often useful in studying the Lorentzian versions of those theories. So just in quantum field theory, if you have a quantum field theory on Minkowski space, then the Euclidean version of that quantum field theory, it's something that you could use to construct a special state of the Lorentzian theory. So the Euclidean version of the quantum field theory, so just on flat Euclidean space, in a sense constructs the vacuum state of the Lorentzian theory. The vacuum correlators in the Lorentzian theory are related by analytic continuation to correlation functions in this Euclidean theory. In the context of gravity, there's also a famous example where the Euclidean version of a gravitational theory is used to construct a special state of the gravitational Lorentzian theory. And that's sort of the idea of Hartle and Hawking, who wanted to come up with a wave function of the universe. And there they said, well, consider the Euclidean version of the gravitational theory and consider basically a gravitational path integral for that Euclidean theory and use that to construct the wave function of Lorentzian theory. So basically in the same way that you would use the Euclidean, a regular Euclidean quantum field theory to construct the vacuum state, they wanted to construct a special state for a gravitational theory. And there are the differences that in gravity with the path integral, you're not just considering some fixed Euclidean geometry, but an integral over a bunch of possible Euclidean geometries that that complete a particular spatial metric. Okay, so given those things, and given the existence of this this Euclidean geometry with asymptotically ADS regions, I think there's a suggestion that maybe the thing we should do is make use of this the Euclidean version of our theory on this sort of space-time with the asymptotically ADS boundary in order to construct a state of this cosmology. And then we can make use of holography to actually define that Euclidean theory. Okay, so this is actually one of the issues with the Hartle-Hawking approach that, if you don't have a UV complete definition of your theory of gravity, you don't really know how to define the Hartle-Hawking wave function. So it's often just taken to be some kind of semi-classical thing, just somehow defining the gravitational path integral. But here we can be a little bit more ambitious. Okay, so our idea is going to be that we're going to consider the Euclidean version of this, of our whatever effective field theory, try to use that to define a state of the Lorentzian theory. And then actually in order to define this Euclidean theory, to define this path integral, then we can use holography because we've actually got this asymptotically ADS boundary here. Okay, so compared to Hartle and Hawking, they assumed that there was no boundary in the Euclidean past, and we're going to basically say, okay, we're assuming there is an asymptotically ADS boundary in the Euclidean past, and use that to actually define the theory. Okay, so that's the goal. Maybe just sort of to summarize this picture then. So we started with this picture on the left, some cosmological space-time. I'm now considering like a more general scale factor. I'm going to be assuming, so like the example of lambda plus radiation, that was a time symmetric cosmology. So I'm going to be assuming that time symmetry going forward. And as I mentioned before, there are lots of examples that would lead you to these time symmetric backgrounds. That time symmetry is going to be important in order to get a real Euclidean geometry when I do the analytic continuation. So the analytic continuation of this is a geometry that looks like this, and it has these two separate asymptotically ADS regions. Okay, sometimes we call this kind of a geometry a Euclidean wormhole because there are two boundaries connected in the middle. And so this is the geometry that we're going to kind of describe holographically and then use to like kind of analytically continue things to describe the cosmology. It will be useful for us to note that there's actually a third geometry, another Lorentzian geometry that comes into play if I analytically continue one of the other directions. Okay. So we're assuming planar symmetry in the cosmology, And so this Euclidean wormhole has just planar R3 slices. If I analytically continue one of those R3 directions to a time direction, then I get another geometry, which is a Lorentzian wormhole. Okay, so it's a static geometry. It also has two asymptotically ADS boundaries, and these are connected in the middle of the space-time. So what I want to do to proceed is try to come up with a holographic description of this Lorentzian wormhole on the right. That's going to be the simplest for us to understand. It's most similar to ordinary ADS CFT. Then we'll basically analytically continue that description to get a description of the Euclidean wormhole, and then do some other analytic continuation to get back to the cosmology. Okay, so in the end, I'll have a specific proposal for how you might holographically describe this cosmology.
So Mark, can I ask you a couple of questions?
Yes, please.
So I guess in real cosmology, that point of symmetry, it's not really empty anymore. You have radiation and stuff that's there in that midpoint there.
Yeah, I mean, it's in our case, it's also very important that that you have matter or radiation. Otherwise, it won't have this structure. So that point is actually a special point where the energy density from matter radiation is exactly equal in magnitude to the energy density from the potential.
Yeah. Good. And the other thing is, this is kind of similar to what Escanderis and McFadden did for their own holographic cosmology, except that I think they had the sitter instead of.
Yeah. So let me just mention that. So indeed, they also wanted to relate some Euclidean theory to the cosmological theory. And so what they were doing is a little bit different, which is that they not only analytically continued a coordinate, they analytically continued a parameter in the metric. And so they went from having a de Sitter cosmology, and then they analytically continued both a coordinate as well as a parameter in order to try to relate that to an anti-de Sitter Euclidean theory. So that was the difference there. And I guess there, one of the confusing aspects is it wasn't really clear from the field theory point of view, what it means to analytically continue this parameter.
Thanks.
Okay. All right. Yeah, maybe at this point, I'll just mention, since we're mentioning other related work, Lotham Boyle and Neil Turok have been talking about a certain approach to cosmology, effective theory approach to cosmology, which also will have some similarities to our final story from the effective field theory point of view. Okay, so our goal though currently is to actually come up with a holographic description of all of this. And so, as I said, we're going to start with this Lorentzian wormhole space-time. So this is a little bit unusual in that you have not just one asymptotically ADS boundary, but two separate asymptotically ADS boundaries. And then these are connected in the middle of the space-time. And so it's a little bit like the two-sided black hole. And so like in that case, the presence of two asymptotically ADS boundaries suggests that our holographic description should involve two three-dimensional holographic CFTs. But it's different from the Euclidean, from the two-sided black hole, in that this space-time is actually static, and you can get from one side to the other just causally going through the space-time. Okay, so it's a traversable space-time, and basically that means that unlike the black hole case, we can't just entangle the two CFTs. We have to make them interacting in some way, because you could perturb the boundary here on one side, and then signals will propagate across, and you'll be able to see that from the point of view of the other CFT. So we need to figure out how to do that. And so the proposal is as follows. So if we just start with the vacuum state of these two 3D CFTs, we're just going to describe two separate ADS4 spacetimes. So we want them to be connected, but we don't want, we want a kind of interaction between the CFTs that is very mild. So I guess one thing to notice is that if I were to perturb one of the CFTs and create some excitation in the bulk, it would take some time to get over to the other side. So there's a time delay between perturbing and being able to detect that perturbation in the other CFT. There aren't any, say, if I have an operator in one CFT and an operator in the other, then I should detect some correlations, but they should be relatively weak correlations. This was pointed out by Kuritsis and Betsios that if you have one operator on one side, one operator the other, then there's no place you can move those operators where you get a singularity. So we proposed last year that a way to achieve that would be to have these two theories interacting, but not directly, rather to have them interacting by an auxiliary set of degrees of freedom, where the two 3D theories are actually physically separated in a fourth direction. Okay. So I want to imagine a 4D CFT, which couples these two 3D CFTs. And that's going to be the proposal for how to holographically describe this thing.
Can I ask, why do you want to couple these two CFTs?
Yeah, it's because the geometry is traversable. So if I can send a signal from one side to the other. And so the sending a signal, so basically if I imagine perturbing one of the CFTs on the gravity side, that creates a perturbation at the boundary. And that perturbation will travel through the space-time and then cause effects on the other boundary. And those would be seen as some effects in the second CFT. So basically there's going to be some non-trivial response function where I perturb one CFT and I measure it in the other. And so that requires there to be some interaction. Okay, but it's a special kind of interaction where it takes a certain amount of time for this to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's kind of the idea. Okay, so I'll give a little bit more motivation for this. Before I go on, I want to emphasize a really important point here, which is that this, while these 3D CFTs are holographic and have many local degrees of freedom, the theory that I want to introduce to couple them, it should not be, I don't want it to be a holographic theory. I don't want to describe a 5D gravity scenario. I still want the gravity picture to be four-dimensional or to a good approximation, having a four-dimensional effective theory. And so the idea is we're going to couple these two, but with a sort of a small n 4D CFT, so relatively few degrees of freedom, so we don't get a five-dimensional bulk. So just a quick string theory motivation for why this sort of construction might be the right way to go. If instead of having like these two boundaries here with many degrees of freedom, if instead I consider just a regular 4D holographic CFT and imagine having some defects, this is a situation that's been studied in string theory. And so if I have defects instead of the boundaries, it's understood that in the dual description, these correspond to certain brains where those extend from the boundary defect into the bulk. And in the bulk, they're dynamical objects. And in some cases, you could just have defects that continue into the bulk and remain separated. But there's a particular case where I choose these defects to correspond to, so I start with a supersymmetric theory. I choose a defect that corresponds to some supersymmetric brain. And then I choose the other defect to correspond to that same brain with the opposite orientation. And this, so this breaks supersymmetry. In this case, in the bulk, I get a brain anti-brain pair, and these tend to reconnect. So the stable solution is one where the brain and the anti-brain connect in the bulk. And so what we want to do in our case is like a version of that, where instead of a pair of defects, we have this pair of boundaries. So the specific construction that I think will work is taking a holographic CFT, which is some, say, superconformal theory, But then choosing the other one to have this reversed orientation. So to preserve a kind of a separate set of supersymmetries so that the combination of these things ends up breaking supersymmetry. So I want to choose an example where this theory is dual to what you could see as some four-dimensional brain. And this theory is dual to a 4D gravity theory, which is like the anti-brain version. And then I think it's natural for these things to join up in the bulk. Okay, so you have this broken supersymmetry, and then as a result, you get this sort of solution. There's a field theory interpretation of this connecting up that happens in the bulk, and that is that here in the UV, we're starting with a 3D conformal field theory, another 3D conformal field theory, and then we're coupling them somehow. And so we can ask about the infrared physics of that. So the infrared, if we're looking at distance scales much larger than the separation between the two theories, the infrared is going to be some 3D field theory. And this picture corresponds to the case where that 3D field theory is gapped is confining rather than being a conformal theory. So this is kind of standard in holographic constructions of confining gauge theories, that you have some infrared end of your space-time. So you can go in radially, but then at some point you reach a wall. And so that's, in this case, provided by this connecting of the two sides. Okay. Yeah, one further point is that there would be another field theory signature of the sort of physics that we want here. And that is that often you have some global symmetry associated with your 3D conformal field theory. This corresponds to the gauge symmetry that would be present in the 4D gravity picture. So you would have some gauge fields here. And this kind of reconnection of brains is understood to be related to a particular pattern of symmetry breaking in the field theory, where your two copies of the global symmetry associated with these two theories gets broken to one diagonal copy.
So can I ask you another question?
Yes.
So are you imagining this is a smooth geometry, the green geometry you're drawing there?
Yeah. I'm imagining this is smooth, and there's nothing special at the midpoint there.
So then, when you analytically continue it back to the Lorentzian time, then you're imagining the Big Bang is a smooth geometry as well.
Well, that is not true. So the smooth geometry in this picture here, it has these two asymptotically ADS regions. But you still have kind of a singularity in the Lorentzian time. Maybe that in terms of analytic structure, that could be a pole or a branch cut. Simplest thing would just be to have a pole in the imaginary time here. And then that would be some kind of a singularity.
Okay. I mean, do you have examples of this? Okay, it's a bit abstract right now.
I think the example to keep in mind is just this particular, this is the simplest example where the scale factor is a cosh in one case, and then over here it's a cos. And so you just have a regular kind of scale factor going to zero. So yeah, it's pretty straightforward. Just see how I'm doing. Okay, good. Okay, so let me just kind of summarize that. Basically, what I was suggesting is that you have this specific field theory construction. So this is going to be our microscopic model of the whole scenario, where we have a 3D holographic superconformal theory. I have another 3D holographic theory, which is like the mirror image of that. And then I couple these things through a 4D theory. And I've argued that this particular quantum field theory, that the vacuum state of that field theory is going to be dual to a space-time like this, where you have two asymptotically ADS regions at either side of this tau coordinate. And so now we can go back to the Euclidean picture. So that's actually basically trivial. We just now consider the R3 version, instead of Minkowski space, we put this on Euclidean space. And so we have a Euclidean field theory that's similar to this one. And we say that's dual to this Euclidean wormhole, or more precisely that this Euclidean wormhole would be the saddle point configuration that dominates the gravity path integral that's dual to this field theory path integral. So just to connect with my previous discussion of constructing a state of a Lorentzian theory from a Euclidean theory, a way to understand this is that we can take the path integral that defines the Euclidean theory, and then we slice it along a particular direction. So in this case, one of the R3 directions, we slice the path integral, and then the path integral on the lower half defines a state for the degrees of freedom on this slice A. Okay, so this is a way to understand how Euclidean theory here constructs this vacuum state. The vacuum wave functional evaluated on a field configuration phi zero on this slice A is given by this path integral, where your boundary condition says that you integrate over all field configurations here in the Euclidean theory with this boundary condition that the fields on A are phi zero. Okay, so that's the path integral to go from here to this vacuum state. But now we want to do a different slicing to define the state that's going to be the state of our cosmology. Okay. So we wanted to use this Euclidean picture here, sliced in a different way to generate the cosmological space-time. And then from the microscopic point of view, that means we're slicing it now on this other direction, which is the direction between the two boundaries. Okay. So let me jump ahead to the next slide. So the proposal is that the microscopic description of this cosmology is where you take this Euclidean path integral, you slice it perpendicular, sort of parallel to this 3D CFT halfway between the two. And so the state that this constructs, kind of bizarrely, is actually a state of a theory which is just this 4D theory, this auxiliary theory that we introduced to couple the two. So that's unexpected, because the 4D theory wasn't even conventionally holographic. But the 3D theory here is still playing some important role. So the idea is we're constructing a state of this 4D theory. The wave functional for the state evaluated on this field configuration phi zero is obtained by taking all configurations of the Euclidean theory, okay, which includes these 3D fields, integrating those with weighted by this Euclidean action, e to the minus Euclidean action, with this boundary condition. So that defines a specific wave function for this like non-holographic 4D theory. And it's a very complicated state, because its construction involves a very complicated field theory. Okay, so it's not like a regular thermal state or a vacuum state of this 4D theory. It's some complicated excited state, where the information of the physics of this Euclidean 3D theory has been inserted somehow. Okay. And so it's maybe a little bit hard to understand, like, why would that describe a theory with this 4D cosmology? And so to understand that better, actually, let's temporarily imagine that the 4D theory here as well is conventionally holographic. Okay, so let's imagine that we're doing a scenario where we do get some 5D gravity picture. And so in that case, if I said, okay, we've got some complicated high energy state of a 4D holographic theory, that would be dual to a particular black hole microstate. So there should be some kind of planar black hole state, which is dual to this state. And the Penrose diagram would look like this. At least if this is the asymptotically EDS boundary, and then we expect that there should be some Schwarzschild exterior. So in this case, we can kind of visualize what's going on. So somehow this state is also supposed to be describing a 4D geometry. And where is that 4D geometry? So if you look at some examples, it turns out that it's sitting somewhere behind the horizon of the black hole. Okay. So in an example where the 43 is also holographic, we can understand what's going on. We've got a complicated state. It's dual to a black hole. And then somewhere behind the horizon of this black hole, there's this end of the world brain. Our 4D gravity theory is describing the dynamics of this object behind the black hole horizon. And apparently gravity is localized there. And it looks like some 4D cosmology.
Mark, can I ask a question?
Please.
Right. Okay. What was my question? Okay. Yeah. So the first question, I mean, you were pretty, well, you've emphasized early on that you don't want the 4D theory in your case, to be like too large N-ish.
Yes.
I mean, is your hope sort of that, you know, if that's the standard model, then you get a cosmology with like a matter content of the standard model or?
No. So let's see. Okay, so in terms of matter content, it's mostly just the dual of the 3D theory. So the 3D theory is dual to some 4D gravity theory, which has other gauge fields as well. And so that's going to be closely related to the standard model, or, you know, in a realistic scenario, that would be where you would want to maybe build in the standard model by choosing the global symmetry of this 3D theory to be like something, some grand unified group or something. The 4D theory does, so it does perhaps add some extra fields. Let's just go back here. So in this picture here, this 5D gravity theory does contribute some degrees of freedom to the 4D effective theory. So in Randall Sundrum type scenarios, you might have some additional fields in your 4D effective theory, which are really coming from the bulk.
Sorry. My question was the what you would usually call the boundary theory. So like the 4D CFT, like in the Randall Sundrum, right. You get like a CFT on your brain. And the reason is because you have a CFT on your boundary.
Right. So, so this 4D CFT here, that gives rise to a 5D bulk in this picture. But then it also gives rise to like a cutoff 4D CFT here.
Right.
So that cutoff 4D CFT might contribute some of the degrees of freedom to the final 4D effective theory. But I think most of the degrees of freedom are going to be coming from this 3D theory, the dual of the 3D theory. So yeah, probably your final effective theory is a combination of those things.
Okay, cool. And the other question I just had, so I mean, in those W holographic cases, right, how I really want to think about, well, like the way I really want to think about this is that in the end, I have this 4D cosmology, which is somehow entangled with like another like non-gravitational system. Do you think that's also like true in your case? I mean, is that how I should think about it?
Yeah. So I think in terms of the effective description of this, you could say there's an effective description here where you have a 4D cosmology and it's sort of entangled with the modes near the boundary over here. So it's like a 4D cosmology theory entangled with a 4D auxiliary theory. And so that would be the effective description. I think that sort of effective description will be there even when there's no 5D bulk. So I think this particular state in terms of the effective description, it's sort of describing this mixed state cosmology where you have both parts.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Okay. All right. So the proposal is that we have this particular state of our 4D auxiliary theory and that is somehow encoding the physics of this cosmology, but it's presumably encoded in a very complicated way. In this higher dimensional holographic picture, the cosmological physics is behind the horizon of a black hole. And we would expect it to be really hard to extract that from the 4D CFT state. So it's a little bit puzzling, but turns out that because we've constructed this state in this very special way, And it's related, like the microscopic construction is related through analytic continuation to the microscopic construction of another simpler Lorentzian geometry. Then the way to actually extract observables in this cosmology would be not to try to extract them from like the state of the 4D CFT, but rather just, you know, go back to this Euclidean picture, or actually, you know, a nice physical way to think about it is to go over to this other Lorentzian picture and realize that there's some relation between the observables in this picture and the observables in this picture. So we've got this underlying microscopic theory. You can slice that path integral in these two ways to either get a state that describes the cosmology or a state that describes this Lorentzian wormhole. And we've already seen that the scale factor in this case is just related by analytic continuation to the scale factor in this case. But actually, pretty much all the correlators should be related. And so if I want to consider something like a two-point function in the cosmology, then, and that would be the kind of observable that we would use to connect with the CMB, for example. So if I wanted to understand perturbations, two-point functions or three-point functions, what I could say is that the two-point function in the cosmology would be related by some analytic continuation to some two-point function that I could calculate in this wormhole spacetime. And actually, the simplest case is to consider the situation. So there's a special time in the cosmology where you have the turnaround point. If I look at the two-point function at that time, then that's actually just equal to the two-point function at the midpoint of the wormhole in this picture. So if I can do calculations in this wormhole geometry, which is static and which is just like a vacuum geometry, then I could just analytically continue those to learn anything that I want to learn about the cosmological physics. Okay. So that's great because now let's think about some particular example. We would have some specific 4D effective field theory that describes the physics in the cosmology. That would be the standard model plus whatever extension we have of the standard model. So instead of considering that 4D effective theory in the cosmology situation, I could just consider it in this picture. In this picture, it's static, it's weakly curved everywhere. And so I just have to understand the vacuum physics of that effective field theory in this spacetime or in this context. Do whatever calculations I want and then analytically continue to recover the physics of the cosmology. Okay. So you don't need to understand anything really about the Big Bang. And you actually don't even really need to understand anything about the UV completion of this effective theory, you know, other than that the UV completion, this theory up here is going to determine what's allowed for the 4D effective theory. Okay. So we can, you know, relatively easily, if we had a specific example, we should actually be able to calculate with it. So let's talk about kind of some generic predictions. Of course, the actual 4D effective field theory is going to depend on which microscopic theory we pick. So there might be many different 3D superconformal field theories that I could feed into this construction. As I mentioned before, the global symmetry in that 3D theory is going to translate to a gauge symmetry in the gravity theory. So we have some direct control over what kind of gauge group we get in this 4D gravity effective theory. So we might want to try to pick something realistic. But I'm going to comment on just generalities going forward and not consider any specific example.
Can I ask a question, Mark?
Yeah, sure.
In the previous slide,
yep.
Is the like on your leftmost picture there? Do I expect that the correlator? Sorry, in the rightmost picture, I meant to say.
Yes.
if I don't evaluate the core, if I move the 2 points in my correlator, you know, to one side of the midline there, do I expect that correlator to be the same as if I move them to the other side of the midline? Is it going to be symmetric?
Yeah, it's symmetric. It's spatially symmetric. So in this picture, you have a reflection symmetry, and that's related to the time symmetry in this picture.
And so in the time, yeah, that's what I was. So in the time, in the cosmological picture now, in addition to the background being reflection symmetric about the point of maximum expansion, also the perturbations will be basically the arrow of time will reverse with the maximum of expansion.
Okay. So that's a subtle question. What I would say is that the full wave function of the universe would have some reflection symmetry, but that wave function is going to be a description, you know, not of just one particular instance of classical cosmology, but presumably many different instances. And so it's an interesting question about, well, how does one particular cosmology with one specific arrow of time emerge from that quantum picture? And so I'm actually not sure exactly how this works. And I think there are two options that I think are sort of plausible. And one of them would be that, you might have the wave function of the universe describe both forward and backward moving cosmologies. And these could be something like separate branches in the wave function. Another intriguing possibility, I think, is that there are rather sort of forward moving, like, I guess, two different bases of the Hilbert space, where one of them sort of like in and out bases in quantum field theory, where one basis would naturally correspond to forward moving physics and the other basis would correspond to backward moving physics. And so it may be that you could actually interpret the wave function either in terms of forward moving cosmologies or backward moving cosmologies. And that would be, I guess, a little bit exotic. It would mean that a particular classical cosmology with a forward arrow of time, you could actually understand it as some very complicated superposition of backward cosmologies. So this is something we need to understand better.
Okay, but so any given cosmology would sort of spontaneously break the symmetry is the bottom line.
I think so. I mean, yeah, of course, I guess the third possibility is that, you know, all of the classical cosmologies are also somehow time reversal symmetric. But I don't really, that one, for me, I don't like it as much.
Tough, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Thank yeah. Okay, so yeah, just, okay, I don't have too much more, so we're good on time here. In terms of predictions, well, we've basically built in R3 symmetry into this construction, and so we're going to end up with homogeneous isotropic flat cosmologies. The R3 symmetry, of course, is going to be broken in individual classical branches. So once we have classical structure, as usual, that will break the symmetry. But in terms of the background, in terms of the wave function, it's going to be homogeneous, isotropic, flat. And so there's not actually, in terms of naturalness puzzles in ordinary cosmology, I would say there's not really a horizon or flatness problem that needs to be solved here if this scenario can give rise to something realistic. Let me just say this in a different way. So in this scenario, the initial state of the cosmology, the time where you're kind of defining the state most naturally through the construction is really this time here, this time symmetric point, rather than at the Big Bang or the Big Crunch. So there are a lot of these naturalness problems in cosmology that say, okay, let's look at our universe now and then go extrapolate back to early in the universe and look at that point. The state would have had to be just extremely, extremely flat and extremely homogeneous. And we need to come up with some explanation because that doesn't seem very natural. So I think in this framework, there's just a different way of asking these naturalist questions. You should really ask those questions at this time symmetric point rather than near the Big Bang. And so that really kind of changes what is natural. What is natural in this context would be, you know, is the state at this time symmetric point, is that something that naturally arises from the Euclidean path integral or from the, you know, from the 4D effective theory in this wormhole geometry. And so I think from that perspective, you don't really have the standard horizon and flatness problems. And actually also, you know, it's kind of obvious in this case that you get correlations basically at all scales. You know, so one of the standard confusing things with cosmology is that, you know, we look out at the universe and there are regions of space that seem to be correlated, even though through a conventional evolution without inflation, those regions were never in causal contact. And so we ask how were these correlations ever established? And inflation gives you a mechanism for that. But I guess in this picture, because the correlations here are the same as the correlations here, and the correlations here are just vacuum correlators in a space-time that's existed forever, you will just naturally have correlations at whatever scale you want. So it's not really puzzling why there should, from this point of view, why there should be these correlations. Okay, so, and then I guess one final thing. So far we kind of set aside this whole discussion about scalar fields and acceleration, just mainly asking, can we construct holographically some example of cosmology? So something that surprised us in the end is that, you know, once we were done with this, we realized that generically in these constructions, you almost always do have time-dependent scalar fields. And those scalar fields almost always do have a positive value of the potential at early times in the cosmology. And so this is the last thing I wanted to say. So as I mentioned, the 4D effective theory, a lot of it comes from just whatever theory is dual to the 3D CFT. And so in ADS CFT, there is a close connection between scalar fields in the 4D effective theory and scalar operators in the 3D CFT. I mean, there's a one-to-one correspondence where the scalar mass in the 4D theory is related to the operator dimension in the 3D theory. Okay. Now, in CFTs, there are often operators which are relevant. So if you take a given 3D CFT, there'll be a certain spectrum of dimensions of scalar operators. And, you know, typically there's going to be a finite number of those whose dimension is less than the space-time dimension. Okay, so in, for example, in N equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, there are 6 of these scalar operators that are relevant. Okay, and so for these kind of scalar operators, those are dual to scalar fields in the gravity picture that have negative mass squareds. Okay, so they have a potential that goes downward. So the effective theory that we're getting here, the 4D effective theory, it's going to have a scalar potential where some finite number of the scalar directions have a potential that looks like this. Okay. The asymptotically ADS regions correspond to sitting here, right at, you know, setting these scalar fields to zero and sitting at the top of this potential. Okay, so it's actually not... the cosmological constant is actually not a minimum of the scalar potential in these scenarios. It's an extremum of the scalar potential. And so if you take those 4D effective theories and you look at, well, what are the generic solutions of those things that are asymptotically ADS? So generically, these scalars that have negative potentials like that, they will run. They won't just remain... You know, there are solutions where they just remain at that extremum, but those are measure zero in the space of asymptotically ADS solutions. So the typical kind of solution will look like this, where in the wormhole, your scalar field will go down. It'll get an expectation value And then at the middle of the wormhole, it'll turn around. It's symmetric, so it'll go back. Okay, and so if we look at the potential, or like the cosmological constant or the dark energy in the wormhole, the profile of dark energy is actually, it's negative everywhere. It's actually more negative in the middle of the wormhole and then less out towards the boundary. But then if you look at the cosmology solutions, you start exploring this part of the potential. Okay, so while the potential goes negative initially, typically interaction terms in these scalar potentials will have the whole thing being bounded below. And so they typically end up going positive. And in the cosmology, the evolution of the scalar field ends up going, or typically it goes from a value over here, comes back to this point at the middle of the geometry, and then goes back up. Okay, so this is the typical evolution of the dark energy in these models of cosmology. It's positive and large, it decreases, and then it's negative for a while, the universe starts recollapsing, and then it goes back up. And so just generically in this sort of scenario, you're going to have a big bang. You know, as usual, matter and radiation will typically dominate early on. But then what can happen is you can still have a positive value of the potential when the cosmological constant starts to dominate. So you can get acceleration. Then the dark energy goes negative. That'll lead to deceleration and collapse. And then it sort of reverses. Okay, so this doesn't happen in every, it doesn't happen in every example. But in many specific examples, you do end up getting a phase of acceleration. Okay. Okay, so that's, I think, it, and probably, yeah, I'm definitely out of time. So the summary is that I think we're making progress on understanding microscopic models of cosmology using string theory if we kind of make the assumption that what we're going for is something with fundamentally lambda less than zero, rather than trying to find these lambda greater than zero solutions. Then it was suggested that that if you take that example, that holography can be used, but in a kind of a funny way. It's used to construct the state of the theory using this Euclidean version of the gravitational theory. So we ended up getting this special state for cosmology. And that was very interesting because in this special state, the cosmological observables were related to the observables in some other Lorentzian space-time, the vacuum observables in this wormhole geometry. And then kind of a nice surprise at the end is that generically in these models, you do actually have time-dependent scalar fields, and they can give rise to acceleration for a while in the cosmology picture before the universe eventually recollapses. So it might be that you could even connect with realistic cosmology. I should say that, you know, at this point, we have no idea. We haven't yet done the calculations about perturbation, so we don't know whether actual realistic models of cosmology could come out of this construction. But I think it's very interesting, nevertheless, just having some microscopic model of cosmology where you can start to ask questions that you can't ask just with an effective description. Okay, so thanks a lot, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much for a very interesting talk. Are there more questions for Mark?
I have a question.
Sure.
Hi, Christian.
Hi. So my question is, when you were defined the state, you introduced some non-local coupling between the two CFT3s.
Yes.
How does that sort of show up somehow in the actual cosmology? Like, how does it manifest?
Yeah. So it's in a sense, it's essential to the whole story. So if we didn't have this coupling, then we would just be describing some single regular asymptotically, well, regular ADS space time. And so by introducing the coupling, we end up with a different background geometry where these two asymptotically ADS regions, which maybe previously just gave two separate space times, now this connects together. So you can think of basically the coupling between the two 3D theories gives you a different kind of vacuum state where the two 3D theories are strongly entangled with each other. And that strong entanglement in the vacuum state of this is what gives rise to a connected space-time. And so then you have the analytic continuation of this thing giving you a cosmology. Without the coupling, basically the whole picture wouldn't work. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Dom?
Yeah. So I was wondering about these regions like near the Big Bang, the crunch, and like my intuition maybe comes too much from these W holographic models. But at least in those, I guess you would expect that, you know, all your like four-dimensional physics starts breaking down. Like, you know, when your brain like falls into the black hole horizon, then you might lose localization and somehow you get these problems that like time evolution, well this is like in a way non-local, as in like signals that come from the asymptotic boundary can actually reach your brain and so on. So am I like, should I expect the same thing here? Like, can you say something about how valid you think this picture in general is, like near the Big Bang and Big Crunch regions?
Yeah, this is a great question. And so we don't have too much, insight yet about what's going on close to those regions. As you said, from this picture, when you do have a 5D bulk, it seems to associate cosmological singularities with black hole singularities. And indeed, in this picture, we might expect that, or it's not totally clear that having a 4D effective description will remain valid all the way to the Big Bang or the Big Crunch. So it might well be that some higher dimensional physics comes into play, some stringy physics comes into play. We did do one calculation in the context of 4D effective theory, where we just took, we basically just took gravity coupled to some CFT as an example of the matter. And there was something a little bit funny that happened because of the, okay, maybe I'll skip the details, but just the outcome of this 4D effective field theory calculation was that we had a Friedman equation, and because of terms coming from the conformal anomaly of this 4D CFT that we were using to model the matter, you couldn't really take the time evolution seemed to start at some particular point where you already had some finite energy density. Maybe you should probably look at my cosmology from confinement paper for the details, but even from the effective field theory point of view, it seemed like there was a point where you actually just could not use the effective field theory. I think in terms of the scale factor, you encountered like a branch cut at this point, at this early time, and so then it wasn't clear what you would even do before that.
Right.
Interesting to explore.
Yeah, this is, I wasn't aware of this until very recently, but, you know, like back around the 2000s, there was also like Eric Verlinde, I think, had a paper where he looked at not this model, but like these models by Gubser, where you have like a radiation dominated universe with zero cosmological constant. And like there, I think there's some story that you can, for example, see where the brain crosses the horizon by a violation of like a Bekenstein bound or something.
Say, okay.
I don't know. I guess that could be, I don't know. It might be interesting to see if it's like interpretation. Of course,
absolutely. Like understanding the Big Bang would have been one of the main reasons why you would want a quantum gravity model of cosmology. Somehow, in the end here, it was interesting that we didn't really need to understand what happens near the Big Bang. So it shifts the question, because somehow the initial state that we thought we needed to find through our microscopic theory, well, actually, it seems like the initial state is the state, in a sense, at the time symmetric point. But right. Anyway, still, there should be enough in here to say what does happen close to the Big Bang because you have a microscopic model.
But is it obvious actually from this picture? So, I mean, what you could do is you could analytically continue the two-point function, like say to very early times, where you might imagine like locality or like local physics to break down. Like, is it, I mean, you start with sort of like an effective field theory, like correlation function, so.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, one thing that could happen is that your effective field theory correlation functions, they may exhibit these branch cuts or pulls or something if you try to analytically continue them too far back in the Lorentzian time. So this is maybe a suspicion of what might show up in the effective field theory point of view. And then you would need to understand that better somehow. How does that get resolved in the more complete description?
Okay, cool. I mean, I have one more question, but maybe if somebody else wants to ask first, then.
I have like a list of 10 questions, but I wonder whether I should wait.
Yeah, I mean, I have no time constraints. But...
Okay. If others don't have questions, I don't know. Maybe you want to end the kind of the formal part of the talk, and then I can ask since Mark is generous with his time.
I have also a question, so let me ask it, and then I will stop there. So, because you mentioned that you want to see cosmology from string theory, I was wondering if you have found this geometry in string theory, because like wormhole solutions in string theory is not something that is very well studied at the moment, right? So have you searched for solutions? And the second part is, I'm also a bit worried about the second analytical continuation that you saw, like in the right-hand side of this slide that you have here. Because for example, to have the wormhole, the Euclidean wormhole, you need some negative Euclidean energy that will support the throat, right?
Yes.
And this could come, for example, from Gates fields. And then if you do the analytic continuation that we see in the right-hand side, you need to analytically continue some components of these Gates fields. And for example, in the example of Einstein-Young-Mills, this analytic continuation gives you imaginary components to the Gates field that you cannot somehow gauge away. So I was wondering, do you really need the second analytic continuation for these models to be useful?
Yeah, so you don't need it. I don't think you need it. But I think that if your Euclidean theory is sensible, mm-hmm. one should be able to use it to describe a sensible state of vacuum state of this Lorentzian theory. So I think this picture should exist if the Euclidean theory is sensible. A possibility is that the kinds of Euclidean theories that we need to describe this cosmology are not necessarily obeying the same kind of constraints that we usually use in ADS-CFT. So it could be an interesting possibility to investigate is whether, say, this 3D Euclidean CFT that's holographic, does that need to correspond to some unitary Lorentzian CFT? Or could it be something more general? Okay. So the existence of this second analytic continuation assumes that these are sort of standard Euclidean theories that would be associated with unitary Lorentzian theories. Mm-hmm. It's possible that you don't need that. Okay, so I should say that we could imagine just having the Euclidean picture and the cosmology picture, and then that's it. I think it's also interesting to consider the possibility that this theory also is normal. And then actually, you brought up a really good point, which is so I think. To support the wormhole geometries, you need something exotic. What we had in mind is more like a quantum energy. So rather than having some classical background with gauge fields, what we had in mind in this picture on the right would be something like a Casimir energy. And so this is actually what we're investigating currently. So you need a large amount of negative null energy, basically, to have a big wormhole. And so you might have thought, okay, well, this is impossible because of some energy condition. Mm-hmm. It seems that there is no energy condition. When you have these boundaries here, if you tried to write the average null energy condition, you would want it to be going from this boundary to this boundary. And there isn't a known version, as far as I know, of an energy condition that would rule out the kind of energy that we need. And then in fact, in a holographic example, I guess last year with Alex and Peter Semenja, we studied a holographic example of a field theory with two boundaries and had that coupled to some other auxiliary theory. And we found that in holographic examples, you can actually find this large negative Casimir energy that you need. So it's apparently a consistent thing to happen in quantum field theories if you have the right boundary conditions. So I guess my current thinking on this is that the 4D effective theory that's give rise to the cosmology, to give the right kind of state, in this picture on the right, you have to have some interesting boundary conditions at the ADS boundaries, not just sort of regular Dirichlet or Neumann, but it's known in quantum field theory that there are many other possibilities of what can happen at a boundary. It's actually very poorly understood. So classifying, you know, possible boundary physics for quantum field theories in higher dimensions is like almost nothing is known. But in 2D quantum field theories where it's understood, it's actually generally a really complicated story. Even for like the Ising model CFT, there's lots of possible boundary conditions and they're not just the standard ones that we think about. So this is my picture for how do you get this exotic large negative energy is that it has to do with some kind of exotic, some kind of interesting boundary conditions.
Nice. Thanks.
Okay.
Then I will stop the seminar. Thanks, Mark, again for a very interesting talk.